Dr. Hudson?
I just wanted to finish on record three a little bit with some of the other findings. So I think it put, in my mind, the results put to rest this concept that mTOR inhibitors should be given frontline to all patients. There was a thought that maybe it was some benefit, it had never been studied before in patients with good or intermediate risk. The second, I was really surprised to see the PFS of in the 7 month range for an mTOR inhibitor. I thought that was interesting given the past phase two experience with sorafenib, originally at 5.5 months, but recent trials suggesting even probably better. And the most recent axitinib versus sorafenib frontline trial had sorafenib's PFS at 6.5 months. So it seems to beat some of our weaker VEGF inhibitors. And then third, I was very interested in seeing that it seemed that the VEGF TKIs, and this I think Bob mentioned before, there's new data with this, and this is the data that comes to mind for me, is that sunitinib does just as good or better for non-clear cell histologies than the mTOR inhibitor everolimus did. So remember, many of the docs in the community still believe what we thought back in 2008 was that maybe there was a reason why we should be giving mTOR inhibitors to the non-clear cell histologies. And so I'll often have doctors call me or send patients in where they've told the patient that you have papillary RCC, a non-clear cell histology, you therefore get temsirolimus as frontline therapy. And that's not necessarily true.
I want to pick up on one thing you mentioned about the sorafenib, because I remember last year at ASCO, one of the discussions was showing the efficacy of sorafenib in sequential trials. I mean, it might have been somebody here, which I always thought was really interesting. And I'm curious, what do you think's going on? So essentially, it seems like in trials that sorafenib has been, as time's going on, is this a function of who's getting in the trials, how the drug's being used? What do you think's going on?
I think all of those. So it's probably multiple influences on that. Certainly there is the effect of the comfort level of the investigator and using the medication. We've seen that across the trials that the toxicities reported in the trials seem to be getting less, with sorafenib suggesting that we're handling those toxicities better. And then there's the differences in the patient populations, that there are these fine details between differences. They're not all exactly the same. They have slight differences in the number of nephrectomy patients. Some were all histology, some were just clear cell. And then whether they were PS0s and PS1s and all these little, these nuances in the trials that seem to matter when we do subset analyses, that they do better. So I think there's probably a combination of all those that explain why we've seen this shift of PFS range from 5.5 months early on with sorafenib frontline. And people have argued that that trial design was faulted, underpowered, to as high as 9.5 months with sorafenib. So that's a big range of activity that I think can be explained by all those that we just reviewed.
Final comment, Dr. McDermott.
So I think we've seen big changes in the outcomes of our patients over the last 10 years, probably doubling of overall survival for the typical patient, which is exciting. I think we need to continue to look for big differences in our clinical trials to get these agents approved, just from practical standpoints, but also that's what our patients are looking for, is how do we make the next big leap? I think the, as Bob mentioned, the immunotherapy VEGF story may be interesting. Certainly when you look at the bevacizumab interferon combination trial, those two drugs together seemed to get more than just an additive benefit. So maybe there's something to immunotherapy plus a VEGF inhibition strategy. And now that we have more active immunotherapies that are in some ways more tolerable than our old cytokine therapies, that those are combinations that should actively be explored.
And I noticed that there are, I was kind of surprised in a way, trials looking at TKIs. I know there was, is it called Nevo now? Is that the new short term? Right. Nemolizumab plus, I think, sunitinib. Is there some thinking that there's a specific immune effect of these TKIs like sunitinib, or how would this happen?
Yeah, I mean, Bob Motzer's done a lot on this, so he can talk about this, but there's data both in mice and in humans that certain TKIs may have some positive effects on the immune system. So they may dampen the effect of regulatory T cells, which are there, we think, to shut off an immune response. They also may have a role at checking the activity of these so-called myeloid-derived suppressor cells, which come from the bone marrow to the tumor and drive resistance. And that's become the basis, that preliminary data has become the basis of the sunitinib plus vaccine combinations that are now in phase three trials. So that's in part steering people to say, well, if this might do something for a vaccine strategy, maybe we should try it with a checkpoint inhibitor. But we have obviously a lot more research to do to see if these things are tolerable and effective. Bob could probably add more to that. Bob Figlin,
yeah. Yeah, I think that, you know, both ourselves and the Cleveland Clinic Group, Jim Finke, have looked at whether or not some of the TKIs have immunomodulatory effects different than their VEGFR inhibition. And I think the consensus is yes, that as David pointed out, effects on T regulatory cells, effects on myeloid-derived suppressor cells, make them an ideal candidate to think about combining with other immunomodulatory agents. That's certainly the background for the Immatic study and for the Argos vaccine study, one using an off-the-shelf HLA-restricted peptide vaccine, the other using personalized immunotherapy generated from a person's own immune system.